Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Brinson, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 2 months ago, The Guardian reported that opponents of the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and Pacific Connector gas pipeline were under increasing surveillance by local law enforcement and the FBI. This came as little surprise to many activists who have suspected that their phones have been tapped or their computers hacked over the past few years. Today, we talk with an expert on civil liberties law, Lauren Regan, who's executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, about why she believes this surveillance violates Oregon state law and why she stated in the Guardian article that, quote, police and corporations are working together to suppress movements against fossil fuel. Lauren, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just came back from Southern Oregon, where I talked to several of the activists who are very concerned about the surveillance, as well as being concerned about trying to stop Jordan Cove and the pipeline. And a couple of them told me how they were not at all surprised about the surveillance because they've had weird things going on with their computer for years, or they've felt like their phones were tapped. And so I'm curious about what how aware you are of the concerns that activists have had prior to this article coming out in The Guardian.
Sure. I mean, I think that probably for the last 5 to 10 years, major corporations that are focused on profiting off of extractive industries have used their money and power in order to try and undercut or repress social movements that are opposed to them. And, you know, I think in general, one way to look at this is, you know, there is sort of a battle going on over the moral compass of society or of our country or even of our communities. On the one side, you have, you know, very few industries with a lot of money and a lot of power and connections to partisan politicians who are singularly focused on providing as much profit as possible to their shareholders, regardless of the impacts on communities, on water, health, et cetera, et cetera. And on the other hand, you not only have these local communities, including indigenous tribes, who are going to be very directly impacted by the negative consequences of these projects, but then you also have this growing state and national and global movement that realizes that instead of thinking about putting another foot of pipeline into the ground, really our most immediate and dire need needs to be digging them up and replacing them with cleaner energy. You know, most scientists are predicting, you know, 10 to 12 years before the consequences of climate change are irreversible. And so there is a growing momentum with regard to normal people, citizens, community members who are becoming very active, but who are also becoming very educated about what those corporations and their industries are going to do to them, to their communities, and certainly to future generations. And that struggle is playing out in a lot of different ways. The corporations, are quoted in the oil and gas journals as saying that they are spending $20 billion on PR campaigns that are targeting and trying to mitigate reputational harm. You know, they are basically saying, you know, they call them anti-fossil fuel activists. We call them climate defenders. But the industry itself is saying that the number one threat to the continued viability of this industry is the activists. And part of that reason is because they are so concerned about this reputational harm, which in plain English means that they are becoming more and more unpopular, and more people are, you know, kind of realizing what they're up to, how what they're going to do, and they're not buying it anymore.
Well, I was just continue, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking about Jody McCaffrey, who's one of the early activists in Coos Bay. Actually, she lives in North Bend, fighting Jordan Cove. And I used to hear her on KBOO many, many years ago, and it felt like she was a lonely voice down there in Coos County, getting a real clear sense of what was being forced upon them and how little support she seemed to have. And now there's a lot of support for what she believes in and what a lot of the other people she's been working with for years believe in. And you can really see it when you go to city council meetings, when you go to the hearings. And I can see why the corporations are, I mean, why they're feeling threatened by these activists. But I guess the question that I have is, I mean, this is not surprising because they did the same thing with Standing Rock and they've done this a lot over the years. But there's something that seems to be particularly poignant about the small community of Coos County having their sheriff's department being in the pay of Jordan Cove, basically, and then not just supposedly being trained to help provide safety for these giant ships that would be coming in and out with LNG, but that they would all, that they're also being used to spy on their constituents. And I wonder if this, because this is happening in such a small community, if this does kind of point more to the contradictions between what we consider to be a democracy that we live in and the fact that we're really living in a society that's completely controlled by these corporations.
Well, these corporations target communities that they think will have no power or ability to fight them, either because they are too poor or they are, you know, the only jobs are working for the industries or related industries. So they're very, very particular in the locations that they target for this kind of environmental harm. And, you know, I would say that it is not uncommon that they will attempt to spy on these activists. In fact, that type of surveillance is common in all social justice movements, you know, and communities of color and other at-risk communities. But, you know, that has never been a successful tactic for the industry. You know, they may monitor people's Facecrack accounts, you know, they may join on certain email lists, but if they think that that is going to provide them with awareness about what actual political activists are doing in their meeting halls, you know, and organizing amongst themselves, they're delusional. And I would also say that, you know, it is a fundamental premise of our democracy that we, the people, can come together and organize ourselves against the state and state power and the accumulation of state power. And when I say state, you know, I mean corporations and the government, because of course we know there is a revolving door of corporate fat cat executives and especially cabinet level people in the Trump administration. You know, you are the CEO of Exxon, and then you become the head of the EPA, and then you leave and go back to making millions of dollars for a corporation. So there really isn't a, you know, much of a distinguishment between corporations and the government any longer. And despite all of that repression that the industry and government attempt to bring upon activists, it also has never been an effective tactic of repression. They can attempt to monitor all of these activists' Facebook pages, but it is in no way going to deter them from fighting. And if, you know, if these big corporations like Pembina think that, you know, getting a posse of law enforcement agencies and FBI agencies to monitor people's Facebook accounts is going to be enough to stop them from fighting that pipeline, they're also incredibly delusional in that regard as well.
But I do think there's a certain amount of intimidation factor, and particularly in communities where the people in Jordan Cove have been at it for so long that I think a lot of them are pretty hardened to the kinds of abuse, actually, and suppression that they're it's imposed on them. But I think that for instance, with Jody McCaffrey, I mean, she's talking about how her computer would just freeze up when she was trying to get comments filed, and she was sure for years that it had something to do with somebody from Jordan Cove, and she's kind of learned to live with it. It's a big hassle, though, but I think the first few times that these things happen where you hear some weird sounds in your phone, or suddenly your calls keep dropping, or you can't get your computer to work to be able to submit comments, it does really, it has a chilling effect, even though you figure out some way to surmount it. And the question that they keep raising is that this is not democracy. And I think in a small community like Coos Bay, there was a little bit more of a maybe naive belief that this country was a democratic country and everybody had the same rights.
Yeah, I mean, we've been down to Coos, you know, Civil Liberties Defense Center, my organization, has been down to Coos County and all of the counties down there doing Know Your Rights trainings and digital security trainings. Because part of, you know, our premise is, you know, as activists, we are taking on the big kids. And we have to take ourselves very seriously because they are taking us very seriously. And so activists, regardless of where you live, you know, have access to training and tools that are offered for free by organizations like mine, in order to be able to use digital security and make it more difficult for corporate and government spies to monitor your communications. We also strongly recommend that people do not use Facecrack for political organizing because it is basically handing over your information to the government. And even though you may not be doing something illegal, like you mentioned, there is, you know, another nefarious intent with that, and that is to chill people from joining us and from being part of political movements. But the number one way to combat repression that is trying to chill people's constitutional rights is by making sure that the bully knows that that tactic will not work. And so the number one way to combat this type of state repression and the chilling of people's constitutional rights is to redouble your efforts and to redouble your commitment to taking yourself a little more seriously and learning what you can about making yourself a more formidable advocate and making you and your community more safe.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Today, we're talking with Lauren Regan, who's executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. We're talking about the recently reported surveillance of activists opposing the Jordan Cove LNG terminal and Pacific Connector gas pipeline in Southern Oregon. One of the things that was striking in the article and also in talking to people down in Southern Oregon is how they claim that what they are doing, the surveillance, that what you call surveillance, they say it's not surveillance, it's open source, whatever, the open source spying, I guess. But anyway, they call it that, it's open source observation of what activists are doing, because they're just going to people's social media accounts and seeing what they're doing. But it looks like it's a little bit more than that. I mean, I heard a story from Larry Mangan in North Bend about an activist in Grants Pass who had said, I guess at a rally, he said, I'm going to do everything possible, anything I can do to stop Jordan Cove. And so they thought that sounded like a terrorist threat. And so they did an investigation of him through the Grants Pass Police Department. That sounds like it's beyond being just kind of open source monitoring. But I wonder about your comments were that this is, in fact, surveillance and it violates Oregon state law. And I wanted to get more of a sense about how you see that the surveillance is illegal and how it measures can be taken to try to stop it from that place.
Sure. I mean, number one, pursuant to our Constitution, both the federal and state, you know, Oregon's Constitution is actually more protective of the right to assemble and, you know, and the right to free speech than the federal Constitution. But pursuant to both of those constitutions, the government, the state, is not allowed to spy on or attempt to disrupt or interfere with political organizing activities of individuals or groups unless they have a very clear criminal nexus. And that nexus doesn't get to be something that they pull out of their rear ends. You know, it has to be actually something real. And what we see over and over by the state in this regard is that they will just call anything and everything, you know, terrorism or the potential for violence. You know, there was a case in Pennsylvania where this group of activists once a week, you know, the group consisted of doctors and teachers. Every Friday, they would go and hold a banner on the street corner, you know, opposing this fossil fuel project. And the government basically started monitoring them. And in one of their quote-unquote terrorist bulletins, they said, you know, they acknowledge, yeah, this group is peaceful. You know, they haven't even done anything remotely criminal. But their rhetoric is getting more militant, and in the future they could become violent. So we should continue monitoring them. And the idea that they can dream up some scenario where sometime in the future a person or a group might, quote-unquote, become violent or you engage in terrorist activities is not what the standard is. And it has never been that. You know, if that is the standard, then all of us are in trouble. Because that net is so broad that it would include everything. And at that point, that level of mass surveillance, you know, is very much intended to take our power away and to accumulate it for the state so that we can't organize and advocate for ourselves. And the other reason that we believe that, you know, what's going on in Jordan Cove in Southern Oregon, as well as many other locations around the country, including Standing Rock, is that federal surveillance or state surveillance, when law enforcement is investigating or monitoring a group, there are supposed to be these minimal guidelines or rules that they have to follow. You know, for instance, they can't, law enforcement cannot come into my office and look through my files without a search warrant or an exception to the search warrant or my consent. And if they violate that rule, then, you know, they can get in trouble. And the evidence they obtain, you know, won't be admissible in court, and that's a violation of my constitutional rights, and I'll sue them and all sorts of things like that. But private spy agencies are not held to those same guidelines or standards. In fact, most of these gray intelligence agencies, as they're called, you know, these corporate private spy hacks, basically will push the envelope as far as they can without getting caught. And so, you know, at Standing Rock, we know that they illegally entered people's dwellings and stole documents and other things. And the important part is when they stole those items, when they broke the law and stole those documents, they turned them over to the government. And the government read them and used them as part of their monitoring and investigation. And so they used the ill-gotten goods of these private security agencies as part of their investigation and their monitoring. And that collusion violates everyone's constitutional rights. If private spies are allowed to break the law and then turn it over to the feds, and the feds get to use that, then there is no Fourth Amendment left. You know, there is no line that they cannot cross when searching and seizing and obtaining information on us. So we believe, you know, that that collusion and the sharing of intelligence between private spy agencies and government spy agencies is absolutely violating people's constitutional rights. And it's really akin to the COINTELPRO litigation of the 70s. You know, during that era, there were lawsuits that said that the spying that was going on of civil rights activists and Black Panthers and other people, the courts ruled that that spying and the intention to disrupt movements that they saw as their opponents or adversaries was absolutely unconstitutional. And the courts shut down that program and said, you cannot do this. But we know for a fact that they actually never stopped doing that. And it has continued unabated. They just hide it, you know, and they don't admit to it. And we've all kind of gone about our, you know, our lives. And so now, especially with this level of digital surveillance that's going on and sort of the mass collection of information online, we think that it's time to really draw a line for these entities and really kind of take them to the mat with regard to these unchecked abuses of our constitutional rights.
Now, you were talking about these private agencies that do spying. Is there a case of there being a connection between a private security company or individual and the surveillance that's been going on in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, the Guardian reported with regard to the Southwest Joint Task Force, the email list that was disclosed in a Freedom of Information Act request not only included FBI, Department of Justice, Forest Service, you know, state and local law enforcement, but it also included a couple of these individuals that are working for these private intelligence firms that are basically like PR firms with a security component. Mark Feifel, I think, is one of the individuals working for one of these organizations. He also was part of the smear campaign team from Standing Rock that, you know, intentionally put out misinformation and propaganda about water protectors. You know, and the other thing I should mention is, you know, during the historic era of COINTELPRO, the government was doing the same thing in terms of trying to paint nonviolent political activists as violent or potentially violent actors, and also made those same kinds of, like, false allegations that maybe sometime in the future they'll do something criminal, so it's fine for us to monitor them. You know, that's just not what the law requires. That's not what our Constitution requires. And that's not even talking about, like, what a huge waste of time and resources. Why are these law enforcement agencies being paid by our tax dollars? You know, why aren't they investigating Pembina instead? You know, why aren't they investigating, you know, all of these leaks and explosions and other things that are impacting the health and safety of hundreds of thousands of Oregonians, you know, and people across the country? The fact that they are spending so much time and money monitoring lawful political opponents of these types of fossil fuel projects also really seems to paint a very clear picture that the government and these corporations are in bed together. They are sharing resources, they are sharing money, they're sharing employees, and that's not how our government is supposed to be set up either. You know, since when has our law enforcement and our federal investigative units been tasked with buoying up and supporting the profiteering endeavors of the fossil fuel industry?
Well, you can see down in Coos County where Jordan Cove basically paid $50,000 to get a county commissioner elected in the last election round, defeating a anti-LNG very environmental candidate. It's very clear that Jordan Cove, in fact, and Pembina, which is the backers of Jordan Cove, basically have, through their financial net, have a lot of control over the political structure of Coos County and the other counties in Southern Oregon. But there is some fight back. Actually, Jackson County commissioners have come out against Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector pipeline. And I've been witnessing that there's a little bit of pushback at the Coos County or the Coos Bay City Council now. And I wonder how communities deal with the kind of money that's being spread around and how it's influenced their politicians. What can they be doing to react and to actually start to hold these people accountable?
Yeah, I would add the Klamath Tribe to that list as well, you know, who has been a powerful and staunch opponent of the pipeline for a long time, you know, the entire Klamath Tribe. And you're right, you know, that is the typical you know, David and Goliath struggle that we see around the country, where the industry, you know, buys giant billboards and brings bouncy houses to the community and, you know, does a bunch of media and propaganda, drives buses full of out-of-state individuals to public hearings or, you know, state land board meetings and other things like that. You know, this is like typical tactics that we see over and over by this industry. But, you know, what you also see is, you know, that Southern Oregon community for over 15 years has consistently and persistently organized themselves and has, you know, kept the pressure on with regard to their opposition to this project. And that opposition is only growing in the face of all of these, you know, incredibly dire warnings about climate change. You know, this will be the first, you know, export terminal of its kind on the West Coast. We should not be building new export terminals for fracked gas. We need to be digging them out of the ground and replacing them at this time. The idea that billions of dollars would be spent on putting this kind of infrastructure into the ground at this time in history is so outrageous. It's just idiotic. You know, it's masochistic. And the fact that the Trump administration has, you know, decided that this project is their number one priority also, you know, just really illustrates the nefarious, you know, relationship between money and, you know, political corruptness.
Well, I was thinking as we were talking a little while ago about the surprise that I think some people in this country feel, particularly in small rural communities, when they realize that there's like the military industrial complex, in a way, the police surveillance industrial complex is coming down on them. And I was thinking about places around the world like Nigeria, where there is a real collusion between, I guess it's Chevron, Shell Oil, and the Nigerian military, which would really violently suppress the people who are protesting the complete despoiling of their country, basically. And to see that this is happening not on quite as violent a scale yet, but in a way in the same kind of corruption of any kind of democratic process. Do you think that this helps people to understand maybe that they're part of a global struggle?
I do, you know, and unfortunately, you know, with Nigeria, you know, we are seeing organizers and leaders of those indigenous communities being murdered by this industry and or the military that is backing the corporation up. So, you know, we in some ways are fortunate in the U.S. that we are able to keep the light shining on this industry and its junta. You know, people toting guns around to the effect that, you know, people aren't being shot and killed at this time. But, you know, as the nation with the largest prison population in the world, you know, we do see more and more activists being targeted with longer jail sentences, more serious criminal charges. And we see these corporations and lobby groups like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, working at the state and federal level to purchase themselves legislation and criminal laws that will further criminalize activism. And their intent with that, you know, again, is to, number one, try and chill people from taking to the streets or in getting involved. And then number two, you know, they hope that people will see these laws being passed and think, oh, well, if the legislature is passing a law that says it's okay for vehicles to run down protesters in the street without any criminal consequences, then those protesters must be the bad people and, you know, those other people must be the good people. You know, and again, that's that moral war that is being waged right now for the hearts and minds, I would say, you know, of people within the U.S. So, you know, there are a lot of different forms that repression, you know, attempted repression against activism takes. But, you know, what I would say, you know, to counter that is, despite all of these laws, you know, being bandied around, you know, many of them never actually get passed into law. The ones that do, they actually don't even want to use them. They put them on the law books, but they hope to not actually charge activists with those laws, because if they do, then we're going to challenge them on constitutionality and likely win, and then the law gets tossed off the books. So it really exposes the true intention of that kind of legislation, which is to scare people and to chill them, you know, and chill their rights and their desires to, you know, fight particular causes. And ultimately, you know, the outcomes of some of these cases against activists fighting fossil fuel industry end up being very much in line with normal outcomes for court proceedings. So at least at this time, you know, although we do occasionally see prosecutors doing the bidding of big corporations, you know, big oil and gas, you know, seeking millions of dollars in restitution from activists, that the court ends up saying, actually, you're going to have $300, not $3 million. You know, the state might look for, 10 years in prison, and the court ultimately ends up giving the person community service. We do see some prosecutors that, are taking the bait, taking, money to help their elections or whatever it may be. But, we haven't necessarily seen disparate impacts, with these changing laws and changing prosecutorial trends. So,
well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking today with Lauren Regan, who's executive director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene. We're talking about the efforts to surveil activists in Southern Oregon who are fighting Jordan Coville and G Export Terminal and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline. I saw when I was down there, I learned something that was actually even more chilling than the surveillance, is that there's another avenue that Jordan Cove is taking now as they've bought out some of the city councils. The city of North Bend is now requiring activists, when they are appealing any of the decisions that are being made regarding permits that would be given to allow Jordan Cove to proceed, that they're going to be charged with fees of $5,000 to $60,000 per appeal, and they call them planning fees. And this is a way to really shut down activist organizations. And I'm wondering, first of all, are you aware of this, and is there any legal recourse? Because it seems to me it's pretty unconstitutional to do that.
Yeah, so the update on that is there is a workaround, and that is that you're just going to skip over those local levels of government and go straight to the state agency and appeal that way. And nobody's going to have to pay that money. And, that process will move forward. But
even LUBA is actually expensive for some of these communities to go through a LUBA appeal, plus it requires a lawyer, though I guess there are some pro bono lawyers working now for them.
There are. But to address your question, that attempt at closing the public process to individuals by imposing an exorbitant fee, just a false, crazy cost. When you close the public process, you are forcing people into a non-public process. The problem with, their, ridiculous tactic in trying to charge that exorbitant fee for people to engage in a democratic process, what they are basically saying is, not only do we not want your opinion, not only do we not want the public involved in this process, but they are basically inviting the public to engage in civil disobedience and other acts, because if you, do not open the public process and allow democracy the full light of day, then basically, there's a saying like, when injustice becomes law, resistance becomes duty. You are basically telling them, like, go at it, because we don't even want you to be engaged in any of like the normal public governmental process. And the other, thing is that type of violation, really is a violation of people's constitutional rights, because it closes the ability to redress grievances against, governments and government agencies. It also closes the ability for people to engage in any kind of like due process, any kind of democratic process. And the courts have repeatedly said that if you charge a fee or you put a cost on something that forecloses people's ability to utilize it without allowing a fee waiver or a fee reduction for public interest groups, for community groups, et cetera, et cetera, then that itself is a violation of both Oregon and federal law. So, I think the long and short of it is those types of attempts, are certainly going to be challenged in the courts, and likely the people, will win those types of challenges, so that places like North Bend will learn their lessons and stop, trying to basically circumvent political process. But the other thing is that there are a lot of great lawyers that are volunteering their time to stand with these communities, and they very quickly, you know, did their research and determined, okay, you're going to put up this roadblock? Well, here's the legal workaround. We're just going to bypass you, and we're just going to go to the state, and we're going to save resources and time, and we're going to, you know, take our appeals and our comments and, you know, go to an entity that allegedly is going to have some higher modicum of impartiality.
But is there also going to be challenges to the these fees that North Bend is charging?
I think it, you know, I think at some point, you know, that will likely happen. You know, I think at this point, the goal is to stop the project, you know, and you know, be as efficient with time and resources as they can. So I'm not sure if a preemptive lawsuit will happen against North Bend at this time, just because there is so much going on right now. And you know, there are only so many lawyers, so many people with so much time on their hands. So I think they want to keep focused on, you know, what the end goals are, you know, and where the fight truly is. And if clowns like North Bend, you know, are going to monkey around in that way, they're just going to get left on the side of the road.
Interestingly, Coos Bay is not imposing those fees. And Coos Bay is also in control of a number of permits that need to be granted in order for Jordan Cove to be built. So I see that there's some cracks in the solidarity that these local governments used to have with Jordan Cove, that possibly, and I'm not sure exactly why, because I'm not down there enough, but I could see that at the city council meeting that I went to in Coos Bay on Tuesday night, that there was a huge show of force, and I thought there were more opponents for Jordan Cove than there were the Pembina people there. So there's some hope, but I just wonder, again, because I get a sense of how frustrated the people in Coos County are, and they're feeling like they have so little resources compared to Pembina, and I just wonder how they can feel more supported, that they know that there's some people with a little bit more financial backing that are at their back to help them through these appeals.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, that's the way it is and has always been. You know, I mean, there's always going to be a disparity of money and resources between those giant corporations and us. But that doesn't mean, you know, time and time again, you know, we, the people, have won. So I don't think that, you know, just because they've got all the money and we don't have much at all means that they're going to win and we're going to lose. You know, that's just not the way the process is supposed to, you know, work. And of course, you know, we can all acknowledge that the system is quite broken and could use some change in and of itself. But, you know, I think we travel around the country to a lot of these frontline communities and landowner communities. Almost all of them are rural, you know, sort of in the same boat as Coos County and the other counties in southern Oregon. You know, this happens time and time again. And I would say, you know, number one, there is, you know, a huge amount of solidarity with these frontline communities around the country. You know, those communities down in southern Oregon are not alone. There are many, many other communities that have been through the same battles. And some of them have won and some of them have lost. And so, you know, there's both some celebration and some mourning within those communities, but learning, you know, what worked and what didn't work and how to make the most of what you do have and, you know, making sure that you are strategic in picking your battles when you do have limited funds. You know, and I think historically, you know, what a number of people have, you know, written and discussed is, you know, they can build it, but, you know, they can't guard every inch of ground, and, you know, the people are opposed to it. You know, they don't want it in their community. They don't want it through their land. And, you know, and just because, you know, the community may lose the battle doesn't mean that they will necessarily lose the war.
I guess I keep thinking about something that Jody McCaffrey has repeated over and over, that once they actually do any of the dredging or blasting or the things that they're proposing in the estuary at Coos Bay, it's over. The estuary can't be restored if it's destroyed. And so it's really, I think, a case of where this has to be stopped before they do any damage.
Well, absolutely. I mean, of course. You know, but I would also say, you know, nature bats last. Yes, you know, once they do ground-disturbing activities, there's irreparable harm that's done to the environment. That is a fact. And that is why everyone, you know, is fighting as hard as they can to make sure that that doesn't happen. But we also know that there is corruption going on. And, you know, the system isn't fair. It's not working in a fair way. You know, we need to expose that unfairness. You know, we need to expose that corruption and that collusion and fight to make sure that it doesn't happen. You know, we need to really invest in local leaders that actually have integrity, you know, get rid of these people that are bought out by the corporation and replace them with local people that will literally, you know, take their community's concerns into account with regard to, you know, these types of projects. But we also know that, you know, this goes all the way up to the federal level. You know, just look at Standing Rock, where, you know, they were winning lawsuits, permits were being denied. You know, it looked like the people might actually win, and then Trump got elected, made an executive order, and now there's oil flowing through that pipeline for now.
For now.
I mean, yeah. For now.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Lauren Regan, who's Executive Director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, about the discovery and response to an article in The Guardian a couple months ago about how the activists who are opposing Jordan Cove LNG terminal in Coos Bay and the Pacific Connector Gas Pipeline have been surveilled by local and federal law enforcement agencies for quite a while. As far as new blood in these elected positions, I got an email from Sam Schwarz, who is the Coos County chairman of the Surf Rider Foundation. And he's been, in the last few years, very actively involved in opposing Jordan Cove and become a more of a spokesperson. So he was emailing us to let us know that he's going to have a new email address because he's resigning from being the chair of Surfrider so he can run for the Coos County Commission. And I was very excited to hear that. And I'm wondering if you're hearing of any other instances of people stepping up like that to take on and take over their elected bodies.
All over the country. You know, that is happening all over the country. And I would say also, you know, in our own state, more and more. And, you know, the power of that is, you know, a lot of folks like Sam are going back to those old school organizing methods. They're knocking on doors. They're meeting their neighbors. They have those one-on-one relationships that are trusted. And no amount of corporate money and window dressing is going to overcome those relationships, those personal relationships of, you know, people that are raising their children together, going to the same grocery stores, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the outsiders, those foreign corporations pouring money into those local communities can never overcome the power of that kind of organizing. And it's really, really important. You know, it's incredibly important. It's something that everyone can do, too, you know, I mean, or almost everyone could do, is either, you know, consider running for an office like that or support someone else that is.
You talked early on about how activists can protect themselves a little bit better, and you use this phrase, face crack. And I would like to talk a little bit about changing our habits so that we don't rely so much on the social media networks that we've been relying on for organizing. So let's talk a little bit about your concerns about their safety and also what people can do as an alternative.
Yeah, it's also called Fedbook, I've been told as well. You know, Facebook and Google, you know, are both extremely corrupted, I guess I would say. They are used over and over and over again by the state and their fellow corporations to not only spy on activists and activist movements, but they are also mapping social movements, They are using, you know, there's even a software program called Beware that uses social media and open source information, you know, like you mentioned at the beginning of the hour, in order to predict civil unrest up to 4 days in advance of it. And so we see Facebook and, you know, Instagram and Twitter and, you know, WhatsApp and, you know, many of these applications, you know, WhatsApp, of course, also being owned by Facebook, you know, you can only trust those kind of platforms to the extent that you trust the corporation behind them. And, you know, and I would certainly say that you should not trust them at all. And so, you know, we definitely believe, you know, I think the other thing to say about the platforms like Facebook is that they were intentionally designed, you know, with psychologists working on them in order to be addictive to people. You know, it's sort of like a gerbil getting a little treat. People, you know, really have become addicted. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've done trainings where activists have said, I know I have to get off this platform. You know, I know I have to stop using Facebook. I know how bad it is, but I just can't. And that was very intentional in the design and implementation of those platforms. You know, like I said earlier, as activists, we really have to take ourselves more seriously. And if you know that these platforms are so highly monitored and being used by the state and corporations to do damage to our movements and to fight us on things like clean water and, you know, a livable climate, then you should not be using them, period. There are a lot of alternatives to these. They may not have all the fancy bells and whistles because they were developed by activists and not giant corporations. But
there's one concern. I mean, there's a couple that I've heard about from activists, but I think one of the appeals of Facebook is that you're not just reaching out to other fellow activists, you're also reaching out to the general community, and so it's seen as a great way to reach people, which it can be. So I wonder, are there interfaces that for activists that also have the ability to reach out to a general population so we're not just speaking to each other?
Well, I mean, I would certainly debate whether or not Facebook actually is an effective way to quote-unquote reach out to other people. You know, because if your activism consists of clicking a like button, you know, good luck in actually winning any real change. You know, it's, I think that platforms like Facebook have made people sit in front of a computer on their couch instead of meeting their neighbors and organizing for real change. And so I think it's a placebo meant to sort of make people apathetic and comfortable. You know, they think that they're doing their activism by trolling through their Facebook posts instead of actually doing the really hard work of trying to figure out how we're going to save the planet, you know, for future generations. I mean, that is not something that you're going to be able to do by glancing through post after post on Facebook. It's going to take a lot of really hard work. And I think that the amount of time that people spend sucking on, you know, that addictive straw is time that they could be spent doing many, many other much more effective things, in my opinion.
Well, are there ways to do something like a Facebook live feed that will reach people? I mean, there's been a whole lot of those happening, and particularly in Southern Oregon, there's been a great use of live feeds, I think, in very good ways. Is there another method to do that that doesn't use Facebook and isn't going to be so prone to being surveilled?
Yes. Yeah, there are. There are alternatives. Although, you know, just to say it, with Facebook Live, you know, what we saw at Standing Rock is the cops would stop the convoys of cars that were leaving to go out to the pipeline route, and they would walk along the vehicles with a device about the size of a laptop, and it would shine into the cars, and occasionally they would stop and open up a car door and pull a person out of the car and arrest them. And what they were doing is, in real time, matching facial recognition images from Facebook Live to the person in the car and using that to arrest people. And so, you know, I know people really like Facebook Live, and, you know, I recognize that there may be, you know, some use that people feel positive about, but overall, I think it's done more harm than good, and people have gotten into a real habit of showing up at a protest and filming the entire thing, and those spy agencies, like the ones that we mentioned at the beginning of the program, just sit at their desks, sipping their coffee, rubbing their hands together with glee at how easy we are making it for them.
So what are these other alternatives that you keep mentioning?
Well, we do an entire digital security for activists training, and it's not my area of expertise, but you know, there are a number of other options that people are developing and using. You can go on our website and learn about some of them. You know, I think that there are many that are also in development by, you know, awesome, smart people that are trying to build alternatives to these platforms. I think one of them is called Jitsi. I think there, you know, there are a number of RiseUp.net has offered some alternatives. You know, there are activist collectives that have been driving alternatives. They're underfunded. You know, they could use some financial support, but they exist. And you know, and I think the bottom line for me is, you know, people have kind of gotten into this knee-jerk response of saying, but it does good, you know, or but it's helpful in this way, you know, maybe so. But I think people need to take a step back and really look at, you know, what are the pros and cons? What are the benefits and the detriments? And not only in the instant moment, but to the overall strength and development of social movements in our country, and in particular, our comrades that are at more risk, you know, that are people of color, indigenous, poor, transgender, you know, those people are even more targeted by these types of platforms. You know, and then if you want to, you know, take it a step further and you look at, you know, the use of, like, the far right in doxing people, you know, which is when they go, you know, and basically troll data that they, you know, find available online, you know, both in the dark web and the public web, and then they use that information to harass people, to show up at their homes, to apply for credit cards in their names, to, you know, destroy their credit ratings. You know, there's all sorts of unfortunate problems to the kind of prolific way that we kind of all were real loose with our personal information and our political information online and using those platforms. And I think, you know, if we go to that framework of taking ourselves seriously and really thinking about this as a struggle for our survival, when you start doing the, you know, the threat assessment of using some of these kinds of platforms, especially if you're using them to discuss political strategy, tactics, targets, et cetera, you know, you're giving a lot away that basically neuters your ability to be effective.
Well, that's a good point to end on. And this is a conversation I'd like to continue, because it's one of my biggest concerns is how we are making ourselves really vulnerable through our obsession with social media. So thanks a whole lot for joining us, Lauren.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We've been talking today with Lauren Regan, who's Executive Director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to KBOO FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or or wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, we'll hear an interview I conducted a couple weeks ago with Naomi Klein, author of a new book called On Fire, as well as footage recorded at the large protest I mentioned a little while ago on the steps of the Washington State Capitol this past weekend, calling on Jay Inslee to declare a climate emergency and stop all frack gas projects in the state. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the Buffalo Springfield. Thanks for listening.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.